This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. Türkiye is a golfer's paradise, and much of that is down to Belek on the country's southern Mediterranean coast. Courses here cut through lush pine forest, set on fast, sandy ground that's kept in immaculate condition all year round. And for those never quite ready to call it a day, Belek is also host to the first full 18-hole floodlit course in Europe. Local pro Dennis Sutmaz is lucky enough to call Belek her training ground.
There are more than 15 courses. You can play golf in winter and summer.
And once the round is done, long lunches replace scorecards and spas, hammams and slow afternoons take over.
When I'm not playing golf, I usually go to the beach, tan, go into the sea. You just feel like you're in another world.
Because in Belek, luxury isn't about excess. It's about time well spent. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumors, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. In this episode, we're looking at Trumponomics, President Trump's promised economic policies, and asking, will they work?
I have made billions of dollars in business-making deals. Now I'm going to make our country rich again.
No small claim. The author of The Art of the Deal and How to Get Rich plans to use his self-proclaimed business acumen to grow the economy, generate millions of jobs, and put more money in the pockets of ordinary Americans.
Mothers and children trapped in poverty in our inner cities. Rusted out factories scattered like tombstones across the landscape of our nation.
At his inauguration speech, President Trump depicted an American economy blighted by the effects of globalization, underinvestment, and bad deals. And he was the man to fix things.
This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
Not a few analysts argue that President Trump actually inherited a fairly healthy economy, with growth ticking along at around 2% and unemployment shrinking. Tonight, on The Briefing Room, I'll be getting the lowdown on Trumponomics, finding out what its policies are and assessing its chances of success. First, Jim Tankersley, Trump watcher and policy and politics editor for the respected American news website Vox, explains what we know so far.
Donald Trump ran in this campaign on a promise to create 25 million new jobs.
I am going to bring back our jobs to Ohio and Pennsylvania and New York and Michigan and all of America.
It was central to his campaign. It was central in particular to his pitch to those former industrial areas in the Midwest, what we call the Rust Belt sometimes in America. Central to that is the idea that he is going to create a lot of jobs and boost wages for everyone via a mix of policies we've never seen before in America.
America is one of the highest tax nations in the world. Reducing taxes will cause new companies and new jobs to come roaring back into our country. Believe me, it'll happen, and it'll happen fast.
Trump is a tax cutter. He wants to be a radical tax cutter. He wants to be a sweeping tax cutter. In the primaries, he proposed what would have been the largest tax cut in American history. He scaled that back in the general election against Hillary Clinton, and it was still the largest tax cut in American history. it happens on two sides, the individual side and the corporate side. For individuals, he wants to reduce taxes across the board. That means lowering rates for very wealthy people, but it also means doing some tax breaks for middle class and lower income people. Secondly, though, there's a corporate tax cut. What Trump wants to do with corporate taxes is cut them dramatically, both for small businesses and for big companies.
Then we're going to deal with the issue of regulation, one of the greatest job killers of them all. Excessive regulation is costing our country as much as $2 trillion a year, and we will end it very, very quickly.
He believes, like many Republicans do, that excess regulation, particularly under the Obama years, has held back growth and job creation. The companies can't hire, can't expand, because they're too burdened by government. So he wants to do several things to roll back regulations. The first that he's done is he has issued an executive order that freezes any new regulations, means the government can't continue through with regulations mandated by current law. And he's also issued a second order that says any new regulation that will eventually be completed must be accompanied by two other regulations pulled off the books.
We will build new roads and highways and bridges and airports and tunnels and railways all across our wonderful nation. We will get our people off of welfare and back to work, rebuilding our country with American hands and American labor.
Trump wants to spend a lot of money on building new things in America, particularly big public works projects. It is unclear how he will pay for this. He produced a plan in the campaign that his campaign said would spur $1 trillion in new infrastructure spending, but it would have been a certain type of infrastructure spending. They want to use private tax credits to incentivize companies to borrow money and then build what would be profitable infrastructure projects. In practice, that means a lot of toll roads or bridges or other places where if you are a private company and you build it, you can get a revenue stream off of it.
President Obama has almost doubled our national debt to more than $19 trillion and growing. And yet, what do we have to show for it?
With his spending proposal on infrastructure and his tax cut proposal, Trump is very much going against what we've seen from Republicans over the last decade. What they say, at least, particularly when they're out of power, is that they want to reduce the federal budget deficit, they want to balance the budget, and they think that deficits and debt hold back growth. In practice, we've seen other Republican presidents run up debt before, usually via military spending. So that's what Ronald Reagan did. That's what George W. Bush did. Trump is proposing that, but on steroids. He's proposing bigger tax cuts than either of the two of them had, and arguably more spending increases than the two of them had, particularly domestic spending increases.
Together, we will determine the course of America and the world for many, many years to come.
And Jim Tankersley will join us later to discuss whether Trumponomics will work. So in short, the policy is create jobs by lowering taxes, cutting regulation, and increasing the amount spent on infrastructure. Can it be done? Trump supporters tell doubters to look at history.
These United States are confronted with an economic affliction of great proportions. Idle industries have cast workers into unemployment, human misery, and personal indignity.
Former President Ronald Reagan is the man that many in America are hoping Donald Trump will emulate.
Those who do work are denied a fair return for their labor by a tax system which penalizes successful achievement and keeps us from maintaining full productivity.
In the 80s, Ronald Reagan, another celebrity outsider, presided over a period of rapid economic growth fueled by deregulation and huge tax cuts. His memory is cherished on the right and centre-right of American politics, and especially by those who worked for him.
My name is Arthur Laffer. I'm 76 years old. I'm an economist, and I've been working in politics and economics all of my life.
Arthur Laffer was a top advisor to President Reagan. His theory that cutting taxes could increase government revenues by creating economic growth became known as the Laffer curve. So what does he make of Trumponomics?
Well, the one thing that I take most seriously that he's proposed is cutting the corporate income tax from about 35% down to 15%. Now, that's at a federal level. If you use state and local, it's about 39.6% to about 19.6%. But that is a very, very serious policy change that will have, I believe, miraculous impact on the U.S. economy and output and employment.
So as you understand what he's suggesting in practice, you think that these would have the impact of creating significant levels of growth?
Yeah, they really would, and they create a very different global environment as well. If you have two locations, A and B, if you raise taxes in B and you lower taxes in A, producers and manufacturers are going to move from B to A.
I was going to ask you, I mean, you advised Ronald Reagan. Now, under the Reagan administration, there was a significant level of growth, wasn't there?
Yes. In fact, once the tax cuts took effect on January 1st, 1983, we had real growth. Now, this is for 18 months, real growth at an annualized rate of about 8% real growth, which is astounding at an annualized rate. And that changed the whole complexion of the country dramatically.
Would you expect to see, under what you understand of Trump's program, an increase in employment?
I would expect to see extraordinarily rapid growth in the United States over the next 4 to 8 years. Number one, he's got a very, very low bar. We've had one of the worst economies in the last 70 years. And with that very low bar, it's really easy to get much more rapid growth than it is when the bar is high. Number two, Donald Trump has control of the White House, the Senate, of the House of Representatives. He has control of the governorships. 34 out of 50 governors are Republicans. State legislatures. Shortly, it's going to be the U.S. Supreme Court and the Federal Reserve. Now, we have not had this type of control of government by any party in generations. So he has all seven positions of political power, which means there's going to be a lot less pushback. And once this machine starts going, it's incredible how it builds up steam and works on itself, and then you'll find a bipartisanship. The Democrats will be coming in, and it'll be a bipartisan pro-growth agenda like we had in the 80s.
So, I mean, I'm gonna put you to the test slightly here, and it's not entirely fair, but given what you've said, if it pans out the way you've just suggested, what kind of rough range of growth level and employment rates and areas of industrial growth would you expect in that period, in the next 4 years?
I think we could get growth rates much higher than what they're talking about, of 4%. I think we can get growth rates in the 5, 6, 7% rates for short periods of time that would have an amazingly positive impact.
7% growth. What I want to know is whether Arthur Laffer is right to be so optimistic. Does President Trump have the policies for America's economy to thrive? And will the economic conditions he creates help the people who voted for him? To help me out on this, in the studio here in London is Professor John Kay, who is visiting Professor of Economics at the London School of Economics and Fellow of St John's College, Oxford. And joining me from the BBC's Washington studio are Diana Furchgott-Roch. She's currently a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and worked on Donald Trump's campaign and transition team. She's also a former chief economist at the US Labour Department. And Jim Tankersley, who we heard from earlier, who is the policy and politics editor for Vox. Diana Furchgott-Roch, do you mind if I ask you a question which kind of springs from the British view of Donald Trump as being somewhat exotic? And that is, why did you want to work on his campaign?
Oh, because I'm in favor of cutting taxes and cutting regulations. And the alternative candidate, Hillary Clinton, wanted to raise taxes and increase regulations. So I very much wanted Donald Trump to win. I wanted to be as helpful as possible. And so I volunteered.
Thank you very much for that. Okay, well, let's look first at the Trump targets, the targets for growth and for employment and so on. John Kay, looking at it in context, would you say that 4%, which is Trump's figure rather than the 7% Arthur Laffer gave us, is a high figure, an easily achievable figure for an economy like the United States?
It's not, certainly not easily achievable, except for shortish periods. If we're to understand what is possible in terms of the growth rate of an economy, we have a lot of countries in the world which are well below their productive potential. But Britain, the United States, most of Western Europe are at what we economists think of as roughly the frontier of what's easily achievable in a modern economy. And the growth in these kind of countries is basically governed by the rate of technological and other progress. And that's typically given us growth of 1.5-2% per head over really very longish periods. Now, in the short term, you can get quite big movements round about that, typically because you have booms, busts, and so on, which means you have lots of economies in which you can get 4 or 5% for a short period when you're in well below your productive potential. Equally, you can push the economy, the capacity of the economy, beyond its real capacity in the short run, but you then get a reaction to that.
And the reaction is?
And the reaction is that the growth doesn't last. You have to catch up, basically, with this underlying growth trend. So unless you can in some way shift that underlying growth trend, you can't have 4 or 5% for very long.
Dinah Fitchcott-Roch, do you agree with that?
Well, I would say that there are many, many things that the administration of President Obama did to slow down growth. Many, many regulations that impede businesses locating here in the United States. We have the highest corporate tax rate in the world, 39%. State and federal taxes compared with an average of 25% for the OECD.
And we're coming to all that later. So in headline, you think 4% is an achievable figure?
Not for several years in a row, but in the short term, yes. But I think it's certainly possible to have a higher growth rate than we have right now. Right now we've had 1.9% for the past year. It's well below our historical averages. We could definitely get it up to an average of 2.73%, for example, on a long-run basis, I would say.
Can I just check with John Kay to see whether actually, in the end, you disagree about that?
I think we're in the same ballpark.
Well, let's look at this question of 25 million additional jobs. That's a very high level of job creation. And, of course, actually, it's a completely flat figure. It doesn't really tell you what kind of jobs and so on. John Kay, what do you make of that as a commitment?
I don't think I understand it. I'm not sure. Are these people who are not currently participating? You know, there are not 25 million unemployed people on welfare in the United States. Are they people who are currently not participating in the workforce? Are they people who are going to migrate to the United States? It sounds like the opposite from what we've been hearing. He seems to be talking about increasing the demand for labour by 25 million jobs. Now, the mantra of every economist is supply and demand. So we have to think both about the demand for jobs and about the supply of jobs.
So, Dinah Fitchcott-Roch, do you understand this to be a rhetorical commitment, or do you understand this to be a real commitment?
I think what President Trump is saying is that he wants to increase the number of jobs. The labor force participation rate in the states now is 62.7%, equivalent to 1978 levels. Before the decade of the 1980s, where millions of women moved into the workforce. There is certainly room to expand on the percent of people who are participating. If we look at the United Kingdom, the share of people participating in the labor force has gone up since 2009, whereas in the States it's gone down. So there's room for improvement there. There's also room for improvement in terms of people delaying retirement, which would also have beneficial effects on the Social Security and Medicare and pension plans. But in terms of 25 million precise new jobs, that was somewhat of a rhetorical flourish.
Now, Jim Tankersley, one of the places where the participation rate, I imagine, amongst that target group is fairly small is in the Rust Belt states. But one of the specific things, I mean, an absolutely specific commitment that Donald Trump made was that somehow or other he would turn round their economic prospects and create jobs for them that pay properly. And the promise felt like a kind of promise of bringing manufacturing industry back to Michigan, Ohio, West Virginia and so on. How's he going to do that?
You're absolutely right. One of the big groups that we've seen a decline of labor force participation in is what we might think of as blue-collar men, men without a college degree, and who Trump is very much promising factory jobs to. So he's trying to do that in several ways. One is trade policy. One is in tax policy. He believes that by cutting taxes on corporations, more manufacturers will hire people. And regulatory is the same way. least by cutting regulations, more hiring will be done. But the other thing is that he is actually going almost door to door to manufacturers and pushing them to keep jobs that they had otherwise said that they might move to other countries. And this is a more difficult way of trying to create millions of jobs, but it's worked for a few thousand, and it's been quite popular with Trump supporters. The question is whether President Trump's overall broader policies, particularly the tax and regulatory policies, can generate that sort of hiring growth and wage growth and economic growth that his supporters are looking for.
I can't resist the opportunity to move on in exactly the way that you've just suggested, because I do want to come on right now to some of these specific measures. Let's look at deregulation first. Diana Fechgott-Roch, I've been in journalism a fair bit of time, and removing regulations is one of those things like cutting middle management that everybody seems to promise every time there's a general election. So in your view, what is sufficiently different about Donald Trump's program that will achieve significant deregulation, and what will it be deregulation of?
One large difference now is that we've had 8 years of regulatory build-up from President Obama. President Obama wanted to pass laws such as one was called cap and trade, which would mean that states have to get together and reduce their emissions as groups. That did not pass Congress, so he put it in place through regulation. States were told to put together state implementation plans with reductions in mercury, ozone, and carbon. In practice, what this would mean is that there would be fewer electricity power plants, fewer factories. So this was basically emptying out the areas of factories that would create jobs. And these factories, many of them went abroad.
Can I just ask you this about deregulation and so on, which you're obviously very much in favour of? But the level of deregulation, which is suggested by the Trump program, is enormous.
Yes.
It's absolutely huge.
So, and justified.
But let me ask you a question I'm going to ask you to be very candid about. A lot of this regulation is stuff that people wanted done. That's why it's there and so on. Some of it may not be, but a lot of it is. Is there nothing in those 75% of regulations that Trump is likely to get rid of that you worry about?
I would actually dispute the premise. If people had wanted it done, then Congress would have passed it. In many cases, the president is going around Congress. For example, there was something called the Paycheck Fairness Act that would have required companies to put down their employees by race, sex, hours worked, wages, so the Labor Department could come and check that they weren't discriminating. The Democratic Congress, under President Obama, refused to pass it. So he's gone in a backdoor way and done it through a regulation. So many of these regulations could not pass Congress as laws. People didn't want them. People still don't want them.
John Kay, you've been listening very attentively to that. As an outsider to this discussion, what do you make of it?
I think we need to go back to the point with which you began, which is the key one, that most regulation is there because there's a popular demand for that regulation. There is very little regulation which is motivated by people saying, thinking, how can I impose some impediments to growth in the economy?
Let's talk about the cutting corporation tax that Donald Trump is proposing, which is a big one, as we heard from Arthur Lafford, from 35% to around 50% or 20%. Diana Fechgott-Roch, can I first ask you why you think, if this is such a good idea, it hasn't already been done?
Well, it's such a good idea that it's been done in almost every country other than the United States. Corporate tax rates have been continually going down, so the United States is out of sync with the other countries.
Now, could companies like Apple start repatriating their profits if they know they don't have to pay 35% or more in tax?
Oh, yes. In fact, we have companies that specifically invert, as we call it, to being owned by foreign companies for that very particular reason. Because if you're an American company, you want to bring back your earnings from abroad, you have to pay about 39% tax on those earnings, minus whatever foreign tax you've paid.
John Kay.
This is quite a complicated issue. Yes. Diane is absolutely right, which is to say that the United States now has a very high corporate tax rate, and because it has not cut its corporation tax rate, while other countries around the world have. Now, it's not at all clear that other countries have received boosts to economic activity from cutting their tax rate. But what is absolutely true and what is correct in what Diane is saying is that if the United States were to change its regime, it could get a once-and-for-all tax boost from the repatriation of these profits which have been lodged overseas into the United States. I don't think it would do anything much for economic activity in the United States, but it certainly would help the U.S. exchequer.
Which is
no small thing.
Can we move on to infrastructure investment? This is something that we heard earlier Donald Trump talking about. He talked about bridges and tunnels and railways and America's crumbling infrastructure and so on. If he wants to do this, Diana Fetchkott-Roche, how will he pay for it?
What he's planning on doing, what he describes, is having the private sector invest in the same way that he took over an old historic post office just down the road from the White House and turned it into a beautiful hotel with his real estate development, and the way he took over an ice rink in Central Park in New York and got it going again. So his idea is an infusion of private sector funds into infrastructure, and this would be made possible by favorable tax rates and, again, repealing some of the regulations that now prevent this.
Okay. What do you make of that, John Kay?
I think there's a whole range of things that issue when people talk about infrastructure. And I'm afraid you heard Trump talking about bridges and tunnels, and you picked up on bridges and tunnels. But in terms of both value for money and ability to get on with things quickly, what we should really be doing is mending the potholes in the road and making piecemeal improvements to New York subways and the like, which are not the kind of things that attract private sector investment very easily. But they're very necessary. They should be done. And if the United States were in a recession, which as a matter of fact it is not at the moment, setting these projects going would be a good way of getting out of it and improving the growth rate.
Now, this brings me, Jim Tanksley, to the, if you like, the crux point of all this, and forgive my kind of lack of understanding, I had understood the Republican Party to be a party of incredible fiscal probity and so on. And increasingly, it doesn't like expenditure by government, and it does not like deficits, and it doesn't like federal debt. And yet, quite a lot of this would seem to add up to the possibility, and it certainly did in the Reagan period, of additional deficit and additional debt. How does this work out politically?
Politically, how it works out is that if you passed the entire Trump program based upon scores from even independent analysts who factor in increased economic growth, you appear to be adding trillions of dollars to the deficit over 10 years.
Now, on the other hand, he has promised to cut the budgets of different agencies and keep them on a steady level, not even have a slight amount of growth. So we should wait and see what his budget is like when it comes out later this month or early in March before we pass judgment on what he's going to do about the deficit.
What a shame, because I was going to ask you to look into your crystal ball right now. And in fact, I still am. 4 years down the road, Jim Tankersley, where do you believe, if I force you to it, the America will be economically?
I think there is a very plausible scenario where America actually feels very good about its economy. Tax cuts come in. We're already basically at full employment. We continue to go at full employment. The growth rate might even boost up a little bit. Basically, everyone across the country gets a raise. I think there's another scenario where there's dysfunction in Congress, where there's not agreement over the right way to cut taxes, where there's not agreement over spending programs, where the Fed keeps raising rates, and where we could see absolutely disappointing growth.
John Kay.
I don't do forecasting, but I can't say I feel very optimistic. But it all depends on the detail, and that's the most important point to get over to our listeners.
Well, for a final thought, I went back to Arthur Laffer, and I asked him, if he was Donald Trump, what would he be worried about?
I'd be worried about trade.
That's all for this episode of The Briefing Room. I'd like to thank my guests, Reagan economist Arthur Laffer, Jim Tankersley of the website Vox, Trump economic advisor Diana Fetchkott-Roche, and Professor John Kay of the London School of Economics. My producer for this episode was China Collins, and research was by Sam Bright. If you enjoyed this episode of The Briefing Room, you might like a BBC podcast called The Inquiry. And if you'd like to let us know what you think about the series, there's an easy way to do it. Just write a review or rating on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumors, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.